Welcome back to The Signature of Man, a podcast dedicated to pursuing truth in the philosophy of art and beauty. This is episode 12 of The Signature of Man podcast, and I'm your host, Miguel Benitez Jr. In this episode, I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Noel Carroll. Dr. Carroll is a distinguished professor of philosophy at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He is known as one of the most important contemporary figures in philosophy of art. Dr. Carroll has a PhD in philosophy from the University of Illinois and a PhD in cinema studies from New York University. In this episode, Dr. Carroll and I discuss the relationship between art and morality. So, Dr. Carroll, thank you for joining me today, and I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you, too.
All right. So, today we're talking about the relationship between art and morality, and you've done a lot of work in this area, and for the listeners, I just want to remind them this is part of a series in which I'm talking to different scholars about this very topic. And for those who haven't read too much on the topic, I actually want to point them to an article that you wrote. This was back in 2000. It's called Art and Ethical Criticism, An Overview of Recent Directions of Research. So it's about 21 years now, but still, for me, it was really helpful when I first kind of entered into the literature, because you lay out the various different camps, the different views, and so it's helpful to kind of get a feel for some of the different views that people take on this issue. And so I thought before we discuss the position that you take on in this discussion, we could start by just discussing some of the other more extreme views that people might be familiar with, or at least to kind of orient ourselves regarding the position you take. So can we start by discussing what people call moralism, or a more extreme form of moralism?
Okay. Roughly by moralism, what I'm going to mean are those who, in one way or another, think that it's appropriate to evaluate works of art in terms of their moral excellence and their moral blemishes. So that would be the larger view. And of course, if you consider the fact that the arts evolved with religion in the earliest stages of human development, the fact that there's a relationship between art and morality is almost natural. And even though today there are reservations about that, many of our artists still are committed to this kind of founding role of art to disseminate moral values. Just think of all of the art nowadays that's concerned with social justice and social injustice. But now moralism can come in many different shapes and sizes. Maybe to clarify things, it's easiest to start with the most extreme versions. The most extreme version of moralism would say that for any work of art, it's appropriate to evaluate in terms of moral considerations. You could have at least two different kinds of extreme moralists. You could have the Puritans, who think that all artworks are morally bad. You know, no dancing, no singing, etc.
Right.
The no fun moralists.
Right.
opposite the Puritans, you would have the Utopians, the ones who think that art is all good, that there's always something morally uplifting about it in one way or another. Art is always morally improving, maybe because it's claimed that it engenders empathy. Both those positions are obviously too extreme. The Puritans have to be wrong. There must be some artworks that are not morally accessible. For example, maybe some string quartets, pure or orchestral music. And on the other hand, it's really incomprehensible to think that all art is good. We wouldn't have things like Triumph of the Will if that was the case, the Nazi propaganda film. So probably the best position for a moralist is to say that it's variable. Artworks can be morally good or morally bad, but that still is a pretty extreme position. If what you're holding is that for any artwork, it's either morally excellent or morally degraded. So even what you might call the variable moralist is holding a pretty extreme position, which seems like it can't be held, pretty much for the same reasons that the Puritan and Utopian versions couldn't, because both of those views confronted counterexamples or counter evidence. And of course, the variable position will just be liable to the counterexamples of the two alternative positions.
Okay, good. And I had a question about that. So just to briefly kind of summarize, because I am interested in this variable position. So the variable position, as I understand it, would say that all artwork, any artwork, is either morally good or morally bad. But this is an evaluation we can make of all art. Is that fair? Is that correct?
That would be the position. Maybe you and your listeners have heard one way this might go. You might say, well, isn't it the case that some artwork is neutral, like the string quartet I just mentioned?
Right. And they would
say, yes, well, being neutral itself is to take a moral position.
Sure. So I'm curious, because in reading Tolstoy's What Is Art, and most people, I guess, would kind of classify Tolstoy in that position, right? The kind of variable, moralist, right?
Yes, the things are either in favor of or supportive of universal brotherhood or not.
Right. And so that at least raised a question for me, and maybe you can help me just think through this briefly. If we live in such a world, and I realize that this now makes some metaphysical assumptions, but if we live in the world, in a world in which, say, the ultimate good for humanity, right, is to glorify God, does that then raise the question regarding art that all art is either doing that or not doing that? Or do you think even someone who holds that position may say, well, no, not necessarily?
Let me make sure that I understand what you're asking. So I would imagine that someone might say to that position something like, well, look at a silver goblet, beautifully designed, right, symmetrical, using all kinds of imagery of foliage. Surely that's a work of art, and it's neutral.
Okay.
Now, a lot is going to depend on whether we're going to accept that as a counterexample. The religious proponent might say, well, it's not, because if it's neutral, then it's blasphemous. They might also say, well, if it has that imagery of foliage, then it's celebrating God's creation. Now, the point, I guess, is what credence we're going to give to those arguments. As we'll see later on in our discussion, you might try and block the objection that it's blasphemous on the grounds that doesn't really consider it as a work of art. That raises an external question.
Okay.
About its place in the larger culture and the belief system of the larger culture and the commitments of that culture. And I guess on this case, that's where I would stand.
Okay.
as a way of trying to block that defense of extreme moralism of the variable sort.
That at that point, we're not asking an art question. We're in a different realm, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you. Okay. And so we've mentioned extreme moralism and some of the different ways that people have gone historically. Tolstoy tends to be kind of that major example. Plato comes up a lot, although in reading Plato, I think one could maybe make a case that he's not necessarily quite in that camp, but that's certainly a discussion for another day. So then on the other extreme, right? So if we're looking at the various views on art and morality as a kind of spectrum, so we have extreme moralism on one end, and then we have kind of the other extreme view, which would be extreme autonomism. And can you explain to us what that is?
Yes. Autonomism, first of all, is the view that art and artistic value is separate from any other kind. It emerges or begins to emerge in the 18th century with the notion that art is the art of the beautiful, and what beauty is really a feeling inside of us, a feeling of disinterested pleasure. And this notion of disinterest is key. Early on, it just means disinterested in the way we expect a judge in a law court to be disinterested, that his personal or her personal interests aren't involved in the judgment that she is making, that she's not assigning a stiff sentence to the person before her because it's her brother,
right.
or because she owes that person by value. But then, as time goes on, especially in the works of Kant, this notion of disinterestedness gets bigger and bigger. So to be a disinterested judgment is to be separate from all other kinds of value, cognitive value, moral value, religious religious value, political value. Artwork is autonomous. It belongs to its own sphere, often as the aesthetic. Now, extreme autonomism would say that because art belongs to its own sphere, moral judgments are never appropriate to works of art. This is an extreme view. It seems like it's an extremely radical view, because even if we're not talking about aesthetic value, it would appear that most of us would agree that there are and have been evil artworks that, even if we said, they're aesthetically good. The film I mentioned before, Triumph of the Will, the Nazi propaganda film, is often thought to be, as a piece of cinema, quite accomplished. But surely we would say it's immoral. It's not hard for us to say, well, certain things may be aesthetically good, but immoral. And so we would allow the two judgments. That's exactly, though, what the extreme autonomous won't allow. The extreme autonomous says that it's never appropriate to evaluate works of art in terms of moral excellences or defects. And probably the most famous the autonomist was Oscar Wilde, who in the beginning or the preface of the very famous novel Picture of Dorian Gray said, you know, that books are not morally good or bad, they're either well written or not.
Right. Yeah. And so the extreme autonomist wants to say art has its own world, and to bring any kind of judgment from outside of that is not an appropriate act. It's not something that would be appropriate in our judgment of the art. So they even, unlike, and we won't get too far into this, but unlike the moderate autonomists, they want to say it's not even a matter of keeping the two judgments distinct. What they're saying is it's not appropriate to make moral judgments of art. Is that right?
Yes. That's a very good way of putting it. And of course, as I said, It seems that if one looks at the historical record objectively, there seem to be evil works of art, and we should be able to actually say that they're evil. Now, even though that's obvious, autonomism, I should say, is very, very attractive to lovers of art. And one of the reasons for that is that it's one of the best defenses that you can come up with against censorship. So if you think back a couple of decades ago to the big debate and dispute about the photography of Robert Mapplethorpe and the trial that was held about it. Well, the defenders of Mapplethorpe brought an army of art historians into the court who gave formal analyses of the beauty of the Mapplethorpe photographs, arguing that the appropriate way of looking at them was to consider them apart from these other extraneous issues of value and to focus on their autonomous value as works of art. So censorship is always attractive tactically, even if philosophically it seems to be an unsupportable position.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that, because it is true that historically censorship has always been a problem, right? A lot of people start aesthetic kind of history with Plato, and we're already talking about censorship at that point. And many times the ones that are doing the censoring do have maybe a simplistic understanding of art and an overly simplistic understanding of art, or have political agendas or whatever the case may be. And so there is this temptation to want to hold that. Whereas if I'm understanding you correctly and what I've read of yours and many others who are involved in this conversation, no one is necessarily arguing for censorship. You can decry a particular work of art as immoral or having a kind of immoral quality to it without saying it shouldn't be permitted to be on display or to be consumed in some way.
Yes, it's very good you brought up Plato. Plato, in his milder moments, did allow that art could be a part of his ideal republic, but only on the condition that it was not only pleasurable, but that the pleasure was beneficial. So right there, as a way you can see, the line is drawn with the autonomist. The right. Autonomist says, no, it's just the pleasure that art can bestow. Whereas Plato said, no, the pleasure, we'll take the pleasure, but as long as it pays the freight, as long as it's beneficial in improving the character, the virtues of the citizenry.
Okay, excellent. And just for for our audience also, this extreme autonomism that we're talking about is often associated with the phrase art for art's sake, right? Is that where that would fall in?
Yes, art for art's sake is one. That was the French version of it. The British version was called aestheticism. As I mentioned earlier, Oscar Wilde is probably the best known aesthete, although the painter Whistler was also an aesthete, and probably the most sophisticated one was a man named Walter Pater, who's less known nowadays.
Okay, great. And so you have promoted, argued for a particular position that avoids the most extreme forms of moralism, but argues against autonomism. So can you let our audience know, what is the position that you have defended over the years? You call it moderate moralism. So what is that?
Let me just give one contextual signpost, and that is that the autonomists themselves realize some of the liabilities of an extreme form of autonomism, and they have a moderate position of their own, which is a divide and conquer, so to speak, position. It says, yes, you can, at least with some works of art, evaluate them in terms of their moral credentials. However, that kind of evaluation is different than an aesthetic evaluation. So that there are a number of different kind of evaluations you can make of works of art. You can evaluate them financially. Do they make money or not? You can evaluate them morally. Are they conducive to positive or negative behaviors? You can evaluate them aesthetically in terms of whatever your idea of aesthetics is. But, and this is where they remain autonomists, moral evaluations are never aesthetic evaluations. To evaluate something morally is never relevant to the aesthetic evaluation of that work. Now, it's that more sophisticated view of autonomism that my view is standing in contrast to. And my view is what we call moderate moralism, which says that at least sometimes, in some cases, a moral defect in a work can count as an aesthetic effect. In other words, those things are not always compartmentalized.
Okay, good. And so that might, for people not familiar with the discussion, that might catch them off guard, because as you said, I do think that because of the history of art being connected to religion and things like that, for many, the idea that there's a relationship between art and morality is very intuitive. For others, as you said, the desires to protect art from some of these outside accusations. But you're taking a position that says sometimes it factors into the aesthetic judgment, but not always. Meaning that there can be instances in which a particular work of art is immoral in some way, but has not affected the overall aesthetic of the artwork. So what is it? What makes the difference? Why is it that sometimes it affects a work of art and other times it doesn't, at least from an aesthetic perspective?
Well, here we have to say at least a little about how we're taking this notion of aesthetic. And I take it that there's some agreement that maybe this is not the entire account of the realm of the aesthetic, but that aesthetic properties are formal or design properties of works. I take it that runs through the tradition. Now, I'm not trying to say that all autonomists are formalists, but most autonomists, I think, will at least agree that something falls into the domain of the aesthetic or the category of the aesthetic if it's a matter of the form or the design of the work. So I'm sure we'll get to this in somewhat greater detail, but just as an opening remark, what moderate moralists are saying is that, well, sometimes a moral defect in a work can be an aesthetic effect if it's a defect in the form of the work or the design of the work. If it's an error in how a work is designed, then it will be an aesthetic defect. And sometimes that will be the case. I mean, you could have a work where there's something immoral in the work, but it's not really germane to the design of the work. And so that's why moderate moralism is moderate. That's why it only talks about some cases.
Okay, very good. And so this seems to tie into what you've called the uptake argument. So can you let us know, what is that? What is that argument for moderate moralism?
Well, here's an example of what I'm calling uptake that has nothing to do with this debate. Okay. Some works are designed so as to elicit or engender a certain emotional response. A horror fiction is supposed to elicit fear and disgust. A joke is supposed to elicit comic amusement. A mystery story is supposed to elicit curiosity. There are various affective states that at least some works of art are designed to engender. Aristotle, of course, thought that tragedies were supposed to elicit pity and fear. So, first of all, a failure of uptake would be if for some reason the work doesn't elicit the affect it's aimed at promoting. So if a horror fiction didn't elicit fear, but as unfortunately some horror fictions do, elicited nothing but laughter, that would be a failure.
Right.
And it would be a failure in uptake.
And that's something that most people can agree on, regardless of where they land in this debate, right? I mean, if a horror fiction fails to elicit fear, I think some have used the example of a thriller not thrilling, or, you know, whatever. That seems to be an inherent failure of that particular work of art, regardless of where you land in this debate.
Right. If you're reading or watching something in the suspense genre and you keep you keep yawning, well, that's a failure of uptake. Now, uptake is going to be a function of the design of the work. That's an important step. And of course, right now you see where the link is that I'm going to rely on, this notion of design. And now, what's sometimes not noticed is that in order to elicit uptake, works have to be designed in terms of, if they're narratives, they have to be designed in terms of the characters in scenes in a way that's going to elicit the uptake or the effective response you want. And just to go back to Aristotle says, if you're making a tragedy, you can't have characters that are too good, because if destruction befalls them, we will be outraged. You know, if Mother Teresa is run over by a tank, everybody's going to be upset. They're not going to feel pity and fear. And similarly, he says, and they can't be all bad either. I mean, you couldn't have the tragedy of Adolf Hitler as we know him, because everybody would say, yeah, he got his just desserts. Right. So you need a character that's somewhat between those two. So you see, I'm talking about this because I want to call attention to the fact that characters and scenes have to be designed. They have to be constructed, right? And if they're not constructed in the right way, uptake won't be secured. Now, what does this have to do with morality? Well, very, very simply, if the characters or the scenes are designed in such a way that they're morally defective, what the work is aiming at is the audience's approval, then uptake will be blocked, right? I mean, look, think of it on an analogy of with humor. You could read a science fiction novel about a civilization in some remote reaches of the galaxy where people think that soda cans are funny. So in that culture, people will put soda cans on the table and everybody will start laughing. Okay, it's easy for you to imagine that there is a place where they find soda cans to be funny. What you can't imagine yourself is that soda cans are funny. So you won't laugh at that joke.
Yeah.
Okay, so you won't be able to perform the imaginative act that would require you to find it funny. Well, in a way, morality is like humor. We could imagine a culture that thinks that eating newborn babies is morally good, but we can't imagine that.
That's right.
If we try to imagine it, we would undergo what philosophers call imaginative resistance. It would be blocked. Okay, so you might design your work so that you're attempting to elicit something, you're attempting to elicit emotional approval for something, but you've made it in such a way, think again of the idea of the tragedy of Hitler, so that we can't imagine it. We imaginatively resist it. So in the tragedy of Hitler, the maker is trying to elicit pity for Hitler. We imaginatively resist that. We can't feel pity for Hitler as we know it. So uptake will be blocked. But that would be a design flaw. And if it's a design flaw, then it's an aesthetic flaw. And sometimes that can happen. I'll just give you a very fast case in D.W. Griffith's very famous film, The Birth of a Nation. He has scenes where he portrays in Reconstruction times after the Civil War, black legislators. And he portrays them in a way that he wants it to be comically amusing. They don't have great manners. They put their feet up on their desks. They eat greasy food with their hands. He means that to be comically amusing. He means it to be a matter of ridicule. But we watch that and we resist it. We recoil. We can't adopt the imaginative frame in which we can process that as a kind of humor.
Yeah, that's a great example. Thank you. So I could see some potentially raising a concern that perhaps this is tied then to the intention of the artist. Do you think that's the case? Do we need to know what the artist's intent was? Or would we say even if it comes across a certain way, it still ends up being a defect because the artist wasn't clear in their expression or presentation?
Well, very often, I do think it is a matter of intention, but I would want to stress that the best evidence for an artist's intention is always the work. And then there's also the context. I mean, we don't need to be talking about having access to the artist's psychiatric tapes. We have the context and we have the work. So it is a matter of what we are intended to. How we are intended to react. Of course, in many cases, that's not so difficult because the genre itself is usually a pretty reliable sign of how we're intended to react. And then if it's a narrative, there's lots of evidence in the text of how we're supposed to react, including, among other things, the reactions of the other characters in the text to the character we're supposed to react to, or the reactions of the characters to the scenes and situations that are being depicted. Right. I mean, there are internal signs of how we're supposed to be leaning one way or another.
Excellent. That's good. So I also wanted to discuss with you an objection that was raised. So Anderson and Dean published an article in 1998. Obviously, you've done a lot of writing since then, but a kind of initial pushback against moderate moralism. And they say that moderate moralism fails to show that something in an aesthetic defect, that something is an aesthetic defect because it is evil, rather than what is shown is that there is an aesthetic defect when an artwork subverts the possibility of uptake. So how do you respond to their objection? So they seem to be saying these can be two separate things that are going on. You've identified an aesthetic defect, but and I don't know that they would word it exactly like this, but for example, to fail to get uptake is not a moral issue, right? And so they're kind of separating the two. The failure, the aesthetic failure, is that they failed to get the uptake, not that there was this kind of immorality necessarily.
Right. Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that's probably the most common objection to my view. And once again, I mean, to get a handle on this argument and discussion, we have to know what they think counts as an aesthetic defect. And for them, something's an aesthetic defect if, and this is a little tricky, something's an aesthetic effect if it's internal to the evaluation of the work as a work of art. Now what does that mean, internal to? Well, maybe a helpful analogy is with guns. Guns can have a lot of purposes. One is to launch projectiles, but some guns are also decorative. Think of all of those beautiful Arab rifles, with silver and gold inlay. I've seen them decorate many walls, for example. Well, what Anderson and Dean would say is that evaluating a gun in terms of its decorative value is not an aesthetic evaluation. I'm sorry, is not an internal evaluation. Why is it not internal? Well, because it's the decorativeness of a gun is external to to its value as a gun, right? Its value as a gun, what we evaluate guns for are things like their accuracy, their power, their range. Those are internal to evaluating it as a gun. Its decorativeness is external, as would be its price. You know, that's a very valuable gun. Why? Well, because it's a very rare gun. It was used by a famous pirate in the 17th century. That would be an external evaluation. Internal evaluations are evaluations that are internal, really, to the kind of thing something is. So as a work of art, uptake for them is an internal evaluation, that the defect is moral is external. There's a famous ancient mythological, I think, story about this tyrant named Phalaris, who had a great sculpture of a bull made, and from this bull, great musical melodies would sound, and people would come and they would be smitten by the beauty of this music. It turned out, though, that the bull was really a prison as well, and inside the bull, the tyrant put his enemies, and underneath the bull there were fires, and his enemies were actually being gradually murdered, executed inside the bull, and their moans were molded by the apertures in the bull in such a way that it was turned into music. So actually Anderson and Dean are moderate autonomists. So
right.
the way the moderate autonomists would think about the brazen bull of Phalaris would be to say, well, the aesthetic dimension of that was what was relevant to evaluating it as music. There's a moral dimension to it too, and that's certainly a defect, the murdering, the persecution of Phalaris's enemies. But that's an external judgment, just as it would be an external judgment of the bull if you said, oh, well, that bull is worth, $100 million, given the amount of gold. So they have this distinction, and
right.
they want to say that the moral defect is not relevant to an internal evaluation of the work. Well, what the moderate moralist says is, no, what they've forgotten is that the scene that D.W. Griffith made of the Black legislature is constructed. It's designed. It's designed to have this effect. It's a design element, and design is certainly, surely relevant to the internal evaluation of the work of art. And a design floor then is an aesthetic floor, and the particular design floor in the cases that are relevant to moderate moralism are problems with the moral design of the scene.
That's good. So to go back to your example of the gun, right? There are decorative guns. And right. So if there's this intention for this gun to be on display and it has some kind of design flaw that is visible, right, when it's on display, then that would be a flaw in its aesthetic. And so what you're saying is, in this construction, the immorality that's on display is designed. It's been made as part of the overall work.
Right. But it was designed to facilitate uptake, but right. Instead it blocks it.
It fails to do it. Okay.
So look, I mean, another way, here's a strange example. Chairs are designed to be sturdy so you can sit on them. Not all chairs are like that, though. There are breakaway chairs that are used in movies and in theaters.
That's right.
And they're not supposed to be stable.
Right.
Would be a design floor in a breakaway chair if when you hit someone on the head with it, it didn't break.
Right.
And we would say that's a bad breakaway chair. And that would be a judgment that's internal to the evaluation of the chair as the kind of chair it is.
Okay, excellent.
I'll leave it there.
No, that's good. Very good. That's helpful. Okay, so we are right up at our time. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap up our conversation here. But first, can you point our audience to any resources if they want to learn more about this ongoing discussion, maybe some of your latest work that you've published on this issue, where they can look for further information?
Well, it's a lively and expanding debate, and there's constantly work coming out on the issue. So it's hard for me to say something without almost automatically being dated.
Right.
I suspect, you know, one good source would be to check out the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which you can access online for free. They do update those articles, and they have extensive bibliographies, and that certainly would be worth taking a look at to get something more recent than the article by me that you cited earlier. As I said, that's always a very reliable source, and it's constantly updated, and it's free.
Yeah. So excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Signature of Man podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, leave a review, and share it out on social media. You can also email any comments or questions to thesignatureofman@gmail.com.